Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, I'm looking forward to our annual Weitzman Symposium this week on the campus of Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, where we gather some of the top thought leaders in health innovation to explore new ways of delivering healthcare and improving patient outcomes.
Well, that's right, Mark. It's the 8th annual symposium, and I think you hit the right note. It's about innovation, but innovation with something to show for in the way of outcomes. That's what we're focused on in our own community health center here in Connecticut and on this show as well. In fact, some of this year's participants have been guests on the show. Dr. Sanjeev Arora is the founder of the Project Echo Telemedicine Program in New Mexico, a program that we've learned from and replicated here in Connecticut and with partners across the country and seeing some great success with that.
Also, Dr. Joe Selby will be participating this year. He's the director of the New Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, also known as PCORI, which was created out of the Affordable Care Act. The center is collecting evidence-based research to improve the patient experience and patient outcomes.
With so much change underway in the healthcare arena, there's also quite a bit of disruption and a time of tremendous opportunity as we find new pathways to improve care and, Mark, I would argue, a good time for consumers as well, which we all are.
And our guest today has been overseeing research on ways to improve patient safety, which still pose a real problem for this country. Dr. Carolyn Clancy is the director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality at the Department of Health and Human Services.
Dr. Clancy's agency just released a report on new guidelines for patient safety practices. It's titled Making Healthcare Safer 2, which looked at a decade of data on patient safety practices in healthcare, ones that are working to improve patient safety, and also looks at those that haven't yielded great results. The report offers some recommended guidelines for hospitals and other practices to pay close attention to if we're going to have the impact we want on the high cost of medical errors, both in suffering and cost.
Some 100,000 patients die each year due to medical errors, and it's estimated that about a third of the $2.7 trillion spent on healthcare in this country is actually wasted. So this is a very timely and important report.
And our Laurie Robertson will check in from factcheck.org and we'll see what untruth she's uncovered in health policy circles this week.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio. And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Carolyn Clancy in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is on the hunt for money needed to roll out the healthcare law. Congress has repeatedly rejected the Obama administration's request for additional funds to help with full implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So the Health and Human Services Secretary is on the hunt for donations from those in the industry to help inform the public about the healthcare law. While the move has drawn criticism from some members of Congress and an inquiry, HHS officials say the request is within the Secretary's right as long as she doesn't ask for funds of subordinates. Spokesman Jason Young added a special section in the Public Health Service Act allows the secretary to support and encourage offers to support nonprofit groups working to provide health information and conduct other public health activities. Maybe transparency is a good thing. The state of Oregon became the fourth state in the nation to publicly post health insurance rates for 2014. Two of the companies posting rates quickly lowered their projected plan proposals for the coming year when they saw the cost of other plans that were posted on the exchange. There has been some concern the health care law would cause insurance rates to spike mightily due to the health care law. Medicaid rolls are about to grow under the Affordable Care Act. A good number of states are expanding Medicaid to provide health coverage for additional folks living near the poverty line, but access is still a real problem. McClatchy News Service surveyed practices nationwide and found fewer than 50% of practices will take on Medicaid patients, even fewer specialists as well, the traditional low reimbursement rate being cited as the reason. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Carolyn Clancy, Director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality at the Department of Health and Human Services. They have just released Making Healthcare Safer 2, a follow-up to their original report that offers a critical analysis of recommended practices to improve patient safety in healthcare. Dr. Clancy is an internist and health service researcher and has been the director of AHRQ, also known commonly as ARC, since 2003. She's a member of the Institute of Medicine and is an elected master of the American College of Physicians and is an associate editor of the publication Health Service Research. Dr. Clancy, welcome back.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare. Carolyn, your agency's mission is to improve the quality, safety, and efficiency of healthcare in this country. And the idea of patient safety took an additional urgency since the release of the groundbreaking report To Err is Human in 1999, which exposed the true scope of medical errors leading to an estimated 100,000 deaths a year in this country. And your department launched its own investigation into the problem and released Making Healthcare Safer in 2001. The report recommended a number of patient safety practices. ARC has just released its follow-up to that initial report, Making Healthcare Safer 2, which has a number of new evidence-based recommendations. Can you take a look at the journey that you've been on and what sort of progress has been made since the launch of the patient safety movement?
What we've learned is that we've learned a lot more about what can go wrong, but we've also learned just how incredibly important it is to understand how to make it right, not just what to do, but understanding how to do it so that the right thing is the easy thing to do and it gets done routinely. This is sometimes called reliable healthcare. Probably our biggest success has been a program called CUSP, which stands for Comprehensive Unit-Based Safety Program. And this is deceptively simple, or apparently simple. When you look at it, it looks like just a checklist. But it's really all about changing the culture. It's about teamwork, and it's about collecting a very small amount of data so that people can see how they're doing. And what we've seen is better than a 40% reduction in serious healthcare-associated infections. We've also seen some successes in hospitals in terms of door-to-balloon time. This is when you have an acute event that might be a heart attack. Part of it is about making sure that a whole large extended team works together almost like a little symphony. And we've seen dramatic improvements on that. Most of the areas where we've seen improvements have been hospital-based because it's a little easier to find and to see. But we're clearly stepping up the focus on outpatient care now.
Well, Carolyn, underlying all of our daily activities, you know, somewhere in the background there's policy often that's driving it. And certainly in these many years since we, of course, have the major event of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and certainly within the Affordable Care Act, although the focus is on coverage, there's much that has to do with improving the quality of care and patient safety. So perhaps share with us what some of those directives are. How are they shaping the work that you're now doing at ARC?
Well, you know, one of the best kept secrets about the Affordable Care Act is just how many provisions in that bill are all about improving the quality, safety, and delivery of health care in general. So some of the broad directives are an alignment of payment incentives to reward the right care. Some of those provisions established a new innovation center at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which actually sponsors demonstrations that link dramatic improvements in quality to changes in payment. It's easy to say, let's pay a different way, but you got to figure out actually how to do that, too. And very importantly, one of the provisions, which is my personal favorite, actually directs the Secretary of Health and Human Services to submit to the Congress a strategy for quality, or a national strategy for quality improvement in healthcare. This is a first, and it has provided a foundation for all of our efforts across HHS in very strong partnership with states and the private sector. And essentially what this strategy says is our overarching aims are better care, better health. Healthcare can be a very strong partner in making sure that our communities and people are as healthy as possible. And the third aim is getting to affordable care, not by cutting services, but by actually accelerating those innovations.
Dr. Clancy, I do want to get back to your statement earlier about changing culture. In the 2001 report, Making Healthcare Safer, ARC issued a list of standard patient safety practices that should be adopted by medical practices and hospitals across the country. But a number of the recommendations received a fair amount of pushback from the medical community. What were some of the problems with early adoption of these patient safety practices?
The prevailing and predominant culture at that time was it is not okay to share when you made a mistake. So people were very, very fearful. Hospital leaders were not having frank conversations about how care could be safer. And that has changed quite dramatically. Now what we hear from people is, how do I do that? Really, the groundbreaking study that we funded on healthcare-associated infection that's associated with central lines, these mm-hmm. are kind of heavy-duty mm-hmm. IV lines, actually changed people's ideas about what was possible. Mm-hmm. And by collecting just a little bit of data and getting feedback every quarter, you know, it was like rocket fuel. So it's very, very important to show what interventions are effective so that clinicians can focus on those activities and avoidable harms that are most likely to be successful.
Well, from a consumer point of view, I'm not sure that folks generally would understand, how do you go about analyzing the various patient safety practices that you looked at to identify what processes actually yield better outcomes? And maybe you could share with us a little bit, what practices have you seen that yield the best safety results?
How we went about evaluating practices was to actually talk to people in the front lines and get their input, as well as patients, about which patient safety practices we should give priority for reviewing. And these in-depth reviews assess these types of practices by asking the following questions. First, how important is the problem? What is the patient safety practice? Why should this practice work? What are the possible harms? So if we see something that indicates that it's actually worked in a variety of different types of situations, that gives them a lot of confidence that it's generalizable or that it will play in Peoria. So the CUSP program is a, you know, clearly outstanding example of a strongly encouraged kind of practice. Some of the other strongly encouraged practices include things like interventions to reduce the use of urinary catheters, because they are often associated mm-hmm. with infections. Bundles, which is sort of a series of steps that include checklists. Hand hygiene, really simple, but really, really important. And very importantly, interventions that have multiple components that are used to prevent pressure ulcers mm-hmm. or bed sores, as they're commonly known, a very, very important source of morbidity. And there are now hospital systems that have gotten their rate of pressure ulcers down to zero.
We're speaking today with Dr. Carolyn Clancy, Director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. They've just released Making Healthcare Safer 2, a follow-up to their original report released a decade ago that offers a critical analysis of recommended practices to improve patient safety in healthcare. What's your thought about training the next generation of healthcare practitioners to the evidence based in the models that you have? Is that making its way quickly enough back into the system of education so that these new upcoming generations are adopting this early on?
It's a little bit like success breeds success. The state of Michigan and all the hospitals there who are participating in Dr. Pronovost's work have dramatic success in reducing a very serious type of healthcare-associated infection, which, by the way, has about a 25% mortality rate. Mm-hmm. You know, when people see those results, they say, it looks like hospitals of all sizes and shapes in Michigan, it worked for them. We could try this too. And now we know that over 1,200 in this country have actually tried it and have had exactly the same kinds of dramatic results. Now, in terms of training, I'm very, very optimistic about that. Very importantly, before you can practice medicine in this country, you have to be clinically trained in a residency program. So these have been accredited for many, many years, but each individual program gets its own accreditations. And a team would come in to look at each one, but the teams that come in don't necessarily talk to each other until now. And the group that accredits hospitals actually got into this because they were responding to a report that the Institute of Medicine did on work hours for residents, mm-hmm. because we had published research showing that very, very long shifts without sleep were associated with a much higher likelihood of serious errors. So they put together a task force on work hours. Well, it turned out you couldn't really separate out the problem of work hours from all of the other factors involved in hospital care that led to safety. And what grew out of that was a new approach to accreditation, where each institution actually gets one overarching visit to find out how do the various residency programs work together on safety.
Mm-hmm.
What does the CEO know about this, and so forth? And that is really a sea change mm-hmm. in how we evaluate these programs.
Well, Dr. Clancy, patient safety and the outcome for the patient is our highest goal. Certainly, we're all very conscious of cost and of the money that is lost and wasted when we have errors. As we see the accountable care organizations forming as a result of the Affordable Care Act, these grouped practices and hospitals and providers who are sharing information and resources to improve outcomes and reduce costs, I wonder if you'd comment on how your report assists these organizations, these accountable care organizations, and practices everywhere for that matter, achieve these improved incomes, but also control costs. And is that something that you're monitoring at ARC?
We are certainly monitoring that very closely. So for this effort that I mentioned before connected directly to the National Quality Strategy, the Partnership for Patients, which is a nationwide effort to dramatically improve the safety of care for people in hospitals. We actually had to go over these practices very, very carefully and, importantly, satisfy an actuary that we had some good estimates about what it would cost to actually put some of these practices into place. The Accountable Care Organizations is a new model of integrating care, which really does change the incentives. But oftentimes, you know, for improving patient safety, you need to put some money in up front. So you might need to have some training programs. You might actually need to hire some additional people. So in a practical world, you need to know, am I really going to save very much money from the safety gains? And the reason we think this is so important, again, is very practical. When resources are limited, it really helps to target efforts around interventions likely to give the biggest bang for the buck. And it helps organizations make priorities in their own environment when they're having a lot thrown at them. It also helps organizations assess what capacity they have. So, for example, sometimes you might need to hire an additional couple of people. Other times you may have people who could very easily meet the needs of a particular patient safety program. So we think it's very important to be as clear as possible about the costs. But we still have a lot more to learn in that area.
Dr. Clancy, ARC's role is primarily a research agency at the Department of Health and Human Services. It wasn't really designed to have the power to enforce the list of new guidelines for patient safety practices. So what other tools are you using in ways of monitoring, incentivizing more widespread adoption of these safety principles? And how do you inspire a participation of the broader healthcare community?
You're right that we're a research agency. We don't pay for care. We don't regulate it. We don't provide it. Now, on one level, that gives us little power. On the other hand, it means that virtually all stakeholders trust the evidence when we say that something works. So they find that invaluable. Because of the National Quality Strategy, that provides this fantastic framework for us to systematically and sort of automatically provide this information to our colleagues at CMS, to private sector payers, who are very interested in seeing what they can do to motivate people to make changes. You probably may be aware that 4.5 years ago, the Medicare program essentially said, we're going to change how we pay hospitals, and mm-hmm. we are not paying extra for patient harms that could have been avoided. And that really, really got people's attention. Engaging patients is really, really critical as well. Now, you always have to be a little bit careful here because you don't want to convey the message at all that we healthcare professionals can't figure it out, so it's up to you now.
Mm-hmm.
But patients can be a very vital source of information when things don't go well. another very successful project focused on avoiding readmissions. This was called Project RED. It was published about 4 years ago, randomized trial, the best kind of study design, we think, and involved the use of an additional nurse and pharmacist. And what they have done since then is to develop a computer avatar that looks like a nurse. And when I first heard about this, I had a tiny bit of skepticism. My father at that point in time was in and out of the hospital a lot, and I sort of imagined him falling asleep in front of a computer screen like he did with the TV. But it's much more interactive than that. You have to keep touching the screen to indicate that you're understanding and so forth. You can go back many, many times and hear the same information again if you didn't get it. And there's follow-up after discharge. We found that that makes a huge, huge difference and dramatic reductions in readmissions. We're also sponsoring a new kind of organization. There was a new law passed called Patient Safety Organizations. Mm-hmm. These are organizations that work with hospitals, doctors, and other healthcare organizations to identify where they are having the most problems with avoidable harms and to evaluate the impact of interventions to reduce those. So our hope with all of this, because these organizations will be sharing data with ARC and we in turn will be publishing it every year, is that we will stop seeing the really tragic situation where you hear about a very tragic patient safety event and then it happens again 2 weeks later. So getting to the notion that we can think about commonality and investigate system-wide fixes, particularly for medication errors, is very, very important. In terms of, you know, where is research going from here, I think, if anything, more focus on the how. How do I do that, as well as the context? Because you really want to know that patient safety practices are sufficiently reliable that they can literally work everywhere and anywhere, and a very strong focus on ambulatory care settings. And we have so much technology and capability now of providing care at home, but you can also see where that could be a recipe for disaster if things aren't done really well. So we're very much looking forward to anticipating what is a need right now, but also what is likely to be a growing future need.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Carolyn Clancy, Director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality at the Department of Health and Human Services, on their just released Making Healthcare Safer 2, a critical analysis of recommended practices that improve patient safety in healthcare. You can see the report and learn more about their work by going to ahrq.gov. Dr. Clancy, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
A pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, several readers have asked us whether Congress was attempting to exempt itself from the Affordable Care Act. The short answer is no. There's no legislation in Congress calling for an exemption from the law. In fact, lawmakers and their staffs face additional requirements that most Americans don't have to meet. They have to switch their insurance coverage from the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program to the healthcare exchanges created by the law. This requirement was added to the law by Republicans when it was being debated. But now there reportedly is concern on Capitol Hill about whether federal contributions to the premiums can continue as usual without some kind of legislative change. Lawmakers and their staffs would be the only employees of a large employer in the exchanges, which are designed for the currently uninsured and small businesses. That's where this exempt claim comes from. A report by Politico said that secret talks were being held by lawmakers to change the requirement to get insurance through the exchanges. But again, no bill has been introduced. Members of Congress and their staffs would be subject to the requirement to have insurance or pay a fine, just as everyone else is. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, Email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.